This episode of Armchair Explorer is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With seven drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. And epic journeys is what we're all about. Learn more at nissanusa.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
My stock in trade is just, you know, idiot undertakes overambitious bike ride. But I didn't really expect it to kind of go in and do a sort of, where's the Cold War over? But it really did pan out in that way.
For many of you, the words Iron Curtain might be something that you read about in history books. But for writer Tim Moore, having grown up in an era of Cold War nuclear drills, the Iron Curtain was more personal, not some faraway line, but a very real and frightening divide. So when an editor asked if he'd be interested in cycling along the length of the entire Iron Curtain on a newly anointed bike trail, he had two thoughts. One was that he was absolutely not in shape to embark on a journey thousands of miles long through some dodgy and uncertain parts of the world which were still tied in his mind to nuclear annihilation. And two, that he was definitely going to do it. Are you ready? Let's go. Welcome to Armchair Explorer, where the world's greatest adventurers tell their best stories from the road. My name's Aaron Miller, I'm a travel writer and your host, and our guest today, Tim Moore, is awesome. He's written several books about his travels around the world. He's very funny, and his writing always takes on some kind of ridiculous bent, which I love. Today, he's going to be taking us from the Arctic Circle to the Mediterranean with no shortage of unexpected twists and turns. I think you're going to really enjoy traveling with him. So I was personally interested in this story because, like Tim, I'm going to give away my age here, the Cold War wasn't just a history book for me. I was 12 when the Berlin Wall fell. And actually, a friend of my parents came to stay with us soon after, and she'd actually been on the wall when it fell down, literally on the wall, helping to chip it down. And she gave us a piece of it, just a little sliver of that concrete all graffitied up, and we still have it to this day. So this was a story I was really interested in telling, and I expected it to be quite deep and poignant. We do go there a little, you guys know me, but actually, it ended up being just way more of a laugh. Not to take away from what those times were, but that's just who Tim is. He's a proper fun, happy-go-lucky guy, and we're going to have a proper fun laugh with him. His book about this adventure is called The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, Adventures Along the Iron Curtain. We'll link to that and some of his other titles in the show notes. And if you want to connect with me, my Instagram is at Armchair Explorer Podcast, and the website is armchair-explorer.com. Come and hang out, sign up for the newsletter. And if you want any travel tips or inspiration, just drop me a line. So I've been chatting with listener Phil Kitch recently, and he's been planning a California adventure, and it's been a lot of fun hanging out with him and talking about that trip. So I really do want to hear from you. We're currently debating Joshua Tree or Sequoia National Park. What do you guys think? I'm torn. I love them both. So get in touch and we can help sort Phil out and plan his ultimate adventure, because we're building a community here of explorers, people who love travel, love the outdoors, and want to live life with the full beams turned on. If that sounds like you, and I'm sure it does, we're going to get on well. So please also subscribe to this show if you can, or leave a review, or tell a friend about it and all that good stuff. The podcast is free to listen to, but it's not easy to make. So if you like it, a great way to say thank you is by spreading the word. Thanks so much for whatever you can do. That really means a lot. But don't worry about that right now, because it's time to hop on our bikes and head out into the cold. Tim has done some crazy stuff. In his early days as a travel writer, he rode a container ship to Iceland. He biked across Italy in period costume, completed the Camino de Santiago in Spain with a donkey as his only companion, and lots more. In short, he's a bit of a nutter. So when one day he received a random phone call from The Guardian's German correspondent, his interest was piqued.
He said, "Oh, I wondered if you've heard of this new Iron Curtain Trail that the European Cycling Federation have just opened." And I thought, well, I haven't heard of the Iron Curtain Trail, nor indeed have I heard of the European Cycling Federation. Because despite having done loads of cycling, I'm not really an actual cyclist. I tend to do stupid amounts of cycling and then do nothing at all for about 4 years and then go off and do a whole load of... So I'd never heard of this federation, but it obviously sounded quite exciting. Until I talked to the guy at the European Cycling Federation, I said, well, how long is this Iron Curtain Trail? And he said, we think it's about 6,000 and something kilometres. So what's that, about not quite 4,000 miles? Obviously, I am at this stage over 50, and that is a really, really long way. But, you know, I can do it. I'll just take it easy. And then he said, oh, actually, in fact, email me back about a week later. So you know what? Actually, sorry, I don't know why I said that. We don't actually know how long it is. So if you do it, you'll be the first person who's done it, and you can just tell us how long it was. So at that point, I should probably have just given up on the whole venture, but I didn't.
The Iron Curtain Trail is officially named Eurovelo 13, or EV13. It stretches from the Arctic Barents Sea to the Black Sea, marking the border between the former communist East and the capitalist West. Experience the history of Europe's division, the official website for the trail proclaims. I still couldn't get my head around the fact, Tim writes, that one could now trace gaily hither and thither across the Death Strip.
I've done a few long bike rides in my life, but I think I realised this was of a whole different order, not just in terms of distance, but in terms of the conditions and everything. So I guess in a way with these sorts of things, you want it to be difficult. I mean, you know, in the end, it's not interesting or funny if things aren't a bit of a challenge. So clearly I'm guaranteed they would be by deciding to take along as my bike this tiny little 20-inch wheel shopping bike, which had been made in an East German sort of communist-run plant in the 1980s. So that certainly guaranteed that things would not be easy.
Tim's bike was, in his own words, a goofy, hopeless, squat little underdog. Even when it was brand new, this bike was no technical marvel. It had no gears and a shockingly inadequate single spoon brake. This was a bicycle which was never built for anything beyond running local errands. And yet, Tim jumped on it and thought ahead in his mind of the several thousand miles of hard riding he had ahead of him. "You probably won't die," his wife said cheerily as he prepared to depart, "but I do worry that you might go mad."
So I arrive in Finland. Number one, I thought, okay, well, I want to see a bit of snow because it's the Cold War, but I thought, I don't want to see too much snow, so I'll just start in kind of, you know, March. That'll be all right, won't it? The day before I arrived, literally the weather was complete whiteout. My outward flight had to be diverted because there was so much snow. They had to, you know, a 4-hour bus ride away in the middle of nowhere. I'd arranged that I was going to sleep in this little motel and then start. But the time I got to the motel, it was 5 a.m. So I paid for the room in advance, so I was going to get some money as well. So I went and sat on my bed looking out the window for about 2 hours. I was just in shock, I think. I really couldn't understand what the hell I thought I was doing. I mean, snow way past my knees, really. I mean, they're very good. There were lots of snow plows, so the roads generally only had a little bit of snow on them. And it was so slow, and I'm undertaking this gigantic journey. And because there's nothing, really, once you cross the border into Finland, which was 1,000 miles from the first, I don't know, 700 miles or so, there would be, you know, 70, 80 miles in between houses, not in between towns, but it was something like 170 kilometres, over 100 miles between shops. So, and that involves obviously pre-planning, which I'm really bad at, and I just kept running out of food. But it was awful, and I think I went slightly mad as well, because there's no, as well as just perpetually hating myself for undertaking this thing without even really thinking about how difficult it was going to be, and being a bit too old, there's no one around, so you just end up talking to yourself and singing to yourself. And what followed was without doubt the most difficult 2 weeks of my entire life.
The mornings began, he writes, with a bleary, fearful peek through many layers of bedroom glass. And 12 hours later, I would stumble into a hotel reception or log cabin and stand there shuddering and melting while my refrigerated, undernourished brain struggled to process thoughts into speech.
Well, the thing is with Finnish people, they're very dour and lugubrious. I came to realise, though, that even though they thought I was a total imbecile for undertaking this thing on a bicycle and, you know, twice a day when a car went past, wind the window down and say, "I think you are not Finnish, are you?" And I said, no, I'm not. "No, because we would not do this. Why are you doing this?" And but then they would say, "Well, if you need help, you will ask." And I realised, actually, that, you know, when I did ask, they were unbelievably helpful. You know, I would just got us into the routine of just rocking up in these middle of nowhere, tiny little benighted settlements and knocking on a few doors, and people would come out and say, "Oh, yes, I think you can stay in the reindeer farm." Or it was kind of really rather lovely in a very unexpected way that these people who are famously, you know, quiet and grumpy would actually just really move mountains to help even an obvious idiot in distress.
After making his way through Finland for two grueling and painful weeks, he arrived at the Russian border with high hopes that things would get easier. They didn't. This episode of Armchair Explorer is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. And Pathfinder, that's a pretty cool name, isn't it? Because that's also what this show is all about. Exploring, getting off trail, having adventures, finding your own path, and living life to the fullest. Sound like you? Yep, sounds like me too. Which is why I'm so excited to partner with Nissan. The 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has 7 drive modes, available intelligent 4x4. It's got the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds. So go ahead and bring all that gear with you and lots more. The 2024 Nissan Pathfinder, a vehicle built for adventures everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at nissanusa.com.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
Tim had been to Russia once before, nearly 25 years earlier, when it was still the USSR. And he found it to be a rather frightening place, he says, with bribe-demanding border guards and suspicion so palpable he could taste it. But that was decades ago. He wanted to see how the country had changed. So he pedaled up to the exact same border post which he had crossed those many years ago, feeling, as he writes, the very same blend of terror and exhilaration percolating in my gut.
I was only really in Russia, when I look back at it, it was probably only like, I think, 4 or 5 days, but it really seemed like the longest 5 days of my life, because it was just endlessly kind of scary from a cycling perspective. When I think about my time in Russia, I just mainly think about a kind of huge, great 1950s truck sort of weaving all over the road and overtaking a bus on a blind corner and coming straight at me. So it all kind of, even though it went on forever, it kind of just sort of passed in a blur of terror. There'd be a little small town and there'd just be almost as if they were there on duty. There'd be a kind of really threatening, nasty looking, kind of slightly bulky guy in a vest, sort of with a can of beer, smoking a cigarette, just kind of staring you out when you came into town. He's just there all day, just like looking aggressive and just trying to sort of intimidate and passing cyclists. And then actually on the last hours, I remember Because whenever there was an opportunity in Russia to not go on a road with cars or lorries or buses, I would take it. So there was a little sort of bit which I guess was some kind of rudimentary footpath, bike path or something. Thank God for that, even though it's going to be much slower. So I went on that, and most of this area was completely pan flat. You could see for miles and miles and miles. And in the distance, I saw, what's that over there? That's a little old sort of babushka lady with a headscarf. Oh, it'll be, you know, a little sort of Russian housewife. And she's doing something. Clearly, as soon as she see me, she was just dragging this huge tree trunk just to lay it across the path in front of me. So when I got there, she just finished. I laid it down. Well, obviously, I could just pick the bike up and carry it over this thing, but I just thought, wow, that's really, really, really going the extra yard to make people feel unwelcome.
With folded arms and a placid air, she watched as I lowered my bike back to earth and remounted. I looked back a moment later and saw her forking the log back to its original station.
When I got to Estonia, which clearly had been part of the Soviet Union when I was there in 1990, and now very much isn't and is part of the European Union, when I saw the little European Union flag on the other side of this bridge, I just burst into tears of relief. And then I go into the first hotel I can find there, and I just go to the receptionist and I said, I'm sorry, I know this is a bad thing to say, but I'm so happy that I'm not in Russia. And she says, I am Russian. In this town, we are all Russian. It was like, oh, because it's right on the border. So it was a very heavily Russian town.
The next leg of his journey would take him through the Baltic states, small countries short enough to cross in just a day or two. In Estonia, he writes about how he pedaled one windless, blue-skied morning as I'd ridden in my pre-departure daydreams, freewheeling through sun-speckled pines on smooth and carless tarmac, the view refreshed by glimpses of twinkling sea and fairy tale woodland cabins. At one intersection in Poland, Tim found himself stopped next to another cyclist who gave him a glance and said, "That is a really daft thing to be doing. But fair play for doing it," basically summing up the whole journey in the process. And then he arrived in Germany, the halfway point of the trail and perhaps the most significant country along his route and the epicenter of the entire Cold War.
The wall that ran right through the middle of Germany was such an enormous construction. Bits of it are still there, and they have also actually kind of preserved bits of it as a kind of warning from history. So that was all pretty extraordinary to see, you know, these watchtowers and things still there and to realise what that meant. But the fact that you could still tell even now, even after, you know, a quarter of a century of German determination, that you could, very particularly when you're riding a crappy old bike, you could tell when you'd crossed what had been the border, because suddenly it would go from lovely smooth kind of asphalt into kind of old cobblestones and things like that. It was really extraordinary to think that there was still such a big difference. And also there'd be very often this very eerie kind of couple of miles of nothing, because on the East German side they had a big exclusion zone, you know, you weren't allowed into, and you might get in trouble, stroke, shot on sight were you to be wandering around in there, because they wanted to keep a nice healthy buffer zone to stop people running away. So that was always a bit eerie. 98% of the wall is gone, because it, you know, in natural terms, it wasn't very long ago. So you'd be riding down a sort of a little hillside and you'd see where the wall had been, and right through the middle of some enormous forest going over the next hill, there'd be this sort of pale green, very low patch of kind of, you know, vegetation that was about kind of waist height, as opposed to all the enormous trees tracing the line of the old wall. So it was kind of an ever-present feature, really, in some ways.
The Berlin Wall wasn't there to keep West Berliners out, but to keep East Berliners in. From 1961 to 1994, the wall served as the global symbol of the division and mistrust of the Cold War. And so when years later, more and more voices from Germany and surrounding nations called to tear the wall down, it wasn't merely a structural change, it was a call for unity. And when it fell in the 1990s, people literally climbed on top of it and pulled it down with picks and bare hands. Today, the wall has been almost entirely dismantled, but some fragments remain standing.
I had a camera which had a voice-activated shutter, which I'd never actually used, really, because it was so silly. But for some reason, any two words that would activate it, one was whiskey, which didn't seem to do the job at all, and the other word, which would have been okay had I been on my own, but there were a couple of people walking their dogs around, and that was shoot. So, and it's windy, and I'm having to shout it out really loudly as this little old lady's walking her kind of Alsatian up and down, and it was not a great moment.
At Outback Steakhouse, your wish is our command. Backed by popular demand, steak and lobster at a special price starting at $19.99. Come enjoy our bold center-cut sirloin seasoned with our signature blend of 17 spices and paired with a buttery, succulent lobster tail. Hurry in to Outback Steakhouse where your steak and lobster wishes come true at a price you can't miss. Steak and Lobster, starting at $19.99. No rules, just right.
Add a berry blast-off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With a new berry way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
After Germany, Tim passed through what he called a long round of the EV13 Hokey Cokey, zipping back and forth from Hungary to Austria, Croatia, Slovakia, and Slovenia. For a fortnight, he writes, I would weave across borders with dizzying frequency, left leg in, right leg out, never spending consecutive nights in the same country. There would generally be some token indication of the frontier, an old border hut or a metal sign with the facing nations on either side of it. But sometimes there was nothing. In 25 short years, we've gone from an iron curtain to a blown down garden fence. And then he arrived in Serbia, where he encountered something more sobering. A group of hundreds of refugees. These were Syrians hoping to cross into the EU via Hungary to seek asylum, but they were being detained at the border.
I was completely taken aback when I'm going up to the border area and suddenly there's this hundreds of refugees just sort of sat in some car park surrounded by sort of policemen. It felt like an enduring theme that this border, which had seen, you know, obviously people crossing over from east to west and getting shot by border guards and just all these other, you know, Hungary in 56 when everyone, you know, loads of people have just fled over these borders in a sense of great panic. So it was very much in that tradition, but I hadn't really expected to confront it in that way. And it was shocking. And it's to think that those sorts of things are still really going on all over the place now. But at that stage in 2015, you didn't really think of that as something you would encounter in Europe, just going around on what at some weird level was a holiday.
The Iron Curtain Trail had been laid out to celebrate the end of a beastly era of division and hatred, he writes. But walls that had come down in 1989 were already going back up. And then in a strange twist of irony, Tim learned after his journey that many of these refugees had ended up entering the EU via Norway instead, in the exact same northern town where he had begun his journey, in exactly the same way.
So lots of Syrians ended up right up near Murmansk, in the very, very northernmost town in Russia. And there was some bizarre little kind of loophole that they were allowed to cross that border if they had a bicycle, not on a car, not on foot, only on a bicycle. It was some sort of weird hangover that someone forgot to erase from the record. And because, you know, the cheapest bike they could get was like a kid's bike with little 20-inch wheels, like my bike. So it was really very, very, very haunting, actually, to see these refugees right near the end of what must have been a horrendous journey, wobbling over this border, which, you know, where I'd been wobbling down it on my silly bike at the start of a very different journey. Before.
From there, he crossed into Slovenia, down through Croatia, and pedaled through a bucolic stretch of trail into Bulgaria.
It was honestly like the Middle Ages. There was this town and people were just leading cattle through the streets. There was just, you know, kind of earthen streets. There was, you know, these no kind of electricity, it seems, in almost all the houses. That was quite compelling to think that in Europe you can still see people out in the fields with, you know, beasts of burden. So I saw a guy ploughing a field with a horse-drawn plough. But Serbia, I kind of didn't know what to expect there. But again, that was rather lovely. And it's quite nice that people when it gets to the stage when they're not just, you know, not used to seeing anyone who isn't sort of from their town, and like, who the hell is this guy? And they were actually just really friendly and curious.
Shaking off each day's scorching heat with an enormous ice cream cone, Tim continued onwards, crossing back and forth through Serbia, Romania, and Bulgaria until he only had Greece and Turkey left. He would start his morning with the far-reaching calls of an imam and finish the afternoon biking past seaside resorts where vacationers lounged. Finally, after nearly 2.5 months and nearly 4,000 miles, the end was actually within reach.
There have been many, many, many moments, thousands of moments. I mean, almost every day when you think this is never going to end, I'm never going to make it. You know, anything could happen, you know, physically or mechanically. It was only really the last 2 days I thought, oh, I'm actually going to do it. It sort of didn't feel real because it's such an all-encompassing, involving kind of thing when you're doing the, I'm not doing anything else. You're not kind of taking a couple of hours out in the middle of the day to like sit down and read a book or go and see some friends or something. You're just on this bike cycling all day, every day. And in the evenings, you're so knackered, you can't really even really kind of, you know, take stock of things or like whatever. So I hadn't in a way prepared for the event. Oh right. I'm actually going to do it. It's a really unnatural situation. You kind of have to kind of get yourself into some sort of appropriately kind of portentous mindset that here I am and I've done it. And I almost sort of went through the motions, like, kind of, oh, I'm going to take the bike and I'm going to put the, because I'd thought about this endlessly, that what am I going to do at the end? The only thing is at the end, on the one hand, oh, you're so relieved to have finished it, but then you get kind of taken over by this really quite ugly sense of superiority over your common man. So you're looking around all these people just sort of sitting in deck chairs on the beach, thinking, like, you don't know what it is to live. I have suffered. What have you done with your miserable, pathetic lives? And actually, because it's such a routine that builds up when you're doing something like this, that by the end of, because it took me, you know, I don't know, 2.5 months or something, it just seems like you're never going to do anything else ever again. You're told, this is it. This is all you can ever do. And when you finish, you think, well, I don't know what to do with myself. How can I ever possibly adapt to normal society? But in the end, it takes about 36 hours and you do, and then you've forgotten that you've ever done this ridiculous thing.
Tim ends the book just before his journey ends, sitting on a bench outside a grocer's shack in one last semi-derelict hilltop border town, waiting to set off on the final leg of his long journey to the shores of the Baltic Sea. Maybe he ended there before those last few miles to portray a sense of the journey not being over, that new walls were still going up. Maybe he did it to offer hope and reflect the ongoing struggle. Or maybe he was just too knackered to finish the book properly. You never know with Tim. What you do know is, man, he likes to ride a bike.
Well, a bike is a great thing. Basically, you know, it's better than walking because walking is just so soul-crushingly slow. You get to really experience your surroundings in a way that you just don't in any other sort of mode of transport because you're with them and, you know, you kind of feel them literally because, there's a hill and I'm noticing this. And you smell everything, which isn't obviously always great. And also, I mean, each day seems to last about 1,000 years. And you look back at the things you did in the morning and you realise you've been through whole sea changes of climate, of culture, of landscape, and you've just done it all under your own steam on this sort of very humble conveyance. I think the lesson of all the things I've done really is absolutely, if I can do it, anybody can do it. I go to, you know, events and things where there are people who want to talk to me about my books, and generally they want to talk to me about my cycling books. And I think quite often they seem to think that I've constructed this character who is a blithering idiot and is physically and technically underprepared, and then they talk to me for more than 2 seconds and realise that I haven't, and that is who I am. So even though I wouldn't necessarily think I've inspired them, because they are probably crushingly disappointed that I am such a twat, you know, I have had, you know, letters and emails from people who have said I didn't, you know, I was at a kind of crossroads in my life and I wanted to go and do something very different, you know, a life-changing kind of life-defining kind of mission. And because you were able to do these things and, you know, that these people wisely took me at face value and realised that I was hopeless, and they went off and did gigantic bike rides or walked the pilgrimage across Spain. And that's very humbling and rather lovely.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks for sharing your madcap, but ultimately brilliant journey with us. It hasn't made me want to ride the Iron Curtain Trail, just in case that old lady with the log is still there, waiting for the next unsuspecting cyclist to come through. But it has made me want to get out on my bike more. I do a bit of mountain biking here and there, but I haven't done any long-distance multi-day journey, so I think maybe a little bit of bike packing is in my future, somewhere warmer than Finland. And if you're thinking the same, we have lots of really cool stories like that. Kat Jaffe riding the hardest mountain bike race in the world is one. I love that. Stephen Fabes riding around the world is another. Both two of my favorite episodes. I'll put those links in the show notes or just scroll down the feed and see what takes your fancy. Tim's book, again, is called The Cyclist Who Went Out in the Cold, Adventures Along the Iron Curtain. He also has lots of other funny books. I want to read that one about him biking across Italy in period costume. What a great way to make friends. So go on, search that up and see what you can find. So thank you so much for listening. And don't forget, if you like this episode, please share with a friend or leave a review or post about it. Anything you can do, it's a huge help and I really appreciate it. You can connect with me directly on Instagram and Facebook at Armchair Explorer Podcast. And if you can, hit that follow button, hit that subscribe button too. It takes just a moment. It means you won't miss a single episode. We have lots of great stories coming up that you're not going to want to miss. So until next time, remember, some of life's most ridiculous journeys are the ones we learn the most from. And there's always something amazing out there to be found, no matter what. Because the more we look for wonder in the world, the more the wonder of the world becomes a part of who we are. Dare to be truly alive. Armchair Explorer is produced by Armchair Productions. Find our other shows at armchair-productions.com. Armchair Explorer is a part of APT Podcast Studios. Jenny Allison did the guest booking and wrote the episode along with me, and Charles Tyree did the audio editing and sound design. Our theme music was written by the artist Sweet Chap. I'm Aaron Miller. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.